Michael's getting a helping hand on his new job. On Freddy's Nightmares.
Hello, air quote friends, and welcome to Primetime, the Freddy's Nightmares podcast. I am your host, Enrique Couto, here with Louis DeNoyer.
I'm so fucking over this
and
already.
I thought you liked this episode, and now all of a sudden you're turning your back.
This is the problem with Louis. What I'm talking about, and you fucking know it.
You cannot count on him.
Oh my God.
He's going to change at the drop of a hat. But this week, we have a very special episode because it's season one, episode 20, Light at the End of the Tunnel. And what?
I'm just going to stare at you right now.
I mean, I can't blame you. I would if I could.
But we are back to Springwood once again. And this episode was fun, but my God, this episode is weird. And not just the stories themselves, but Freddy's interactions.
No, this show is... I don't know. It has quite an energy to it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's a nice way of putting it.
No, I mean, it really does. The opening alone is just... the way they did it, this episode did something I thought was really cool, which was, obviously, Freddy breaks the fourth wall all the time.
All the
but,
time.
Like, Freddy broke, like, the fifth wall.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
On this one.
Yeah.
He went way beyond that namby-pamby fourth wall everybody's always talking about.
Yeah, when this episode started, because I've watched this episode twice now in under 24 hours. I watched it last night, and then I did my notes today for it. And each time that the intro, which we'll talk about here in a second, starts, I was just like, this is, what is going on? Like, this is magical and strange, and I love every second of it. And Freddy is right on top of his game as usual.
I mean, Freddy is definitely at his most Freddy.
That he is. So you want to get into it?
Into what?
Into politics, dinner plans.
They're turning the friggin' frogs gay.
So, as Hendrick said, we are talking about season one, episode 20, The Light at the End of the Tunnel. Original air date was May 14th, 15th, 1989. This episode is written and directed by Jonathan R. Boutel. He was the director of one of our favorite episodes from the season, The End of the World. He also is the director of the film My Science Project, Theodore Rex, and he's also the writer of The Last Starfighter.
And we talked about last time how I actually thought Theodore Rex was something I'd made up as a child.
Yeah, and it wasn't.
No,
it was real.
I would like literally be like, hey, he's ever like a dinosaur, Whoopi Goldberg. Kids are weird. And then one day it was on cable when I was like 14, and I was like, well, I'll be dipped in shit.
And another writing credit I do want to throw out is James Capp is attached to this episode as well.
Yes.
For a story. So he did some story elements for it as well. And we got a surprise with him hopefully soon that we'll talk about.
I mean, do we really need to hide it? I mean, we don't know. We're not going to guarantee that we'll have him next week.
Yeah.
But James is actually... He wrote us.
Yes, he did.
On the first episode that we did, he sent us a nice message, and he listens every week, which blows my mind.
Yeah.
And I mean this with all love, JC. It just blows my mind that you've made it a part of your week to like sit back and listen to me and Dave. I'm sorry, Louis.
Oh my God.
I'm so sorry,
you
Dave.
You had it
Louis,
for a second.
I am so sorry, Louis. I'm trying not to dead name you.
I hate you.
But no, we're really flattered that you check us out.
Yeah.
You listen.
Thank you so
and
much.
And that you're willing to sit down with us because, no joke, one of my favorite episodes is the episode he wrote.
Yeah.
The end of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I know that he wrote on The Light at the End of the Tunnel, and this one is also very interesting.
Very much so.
And a lot of fun, so I think it's going to be really cool to get to pick JC's brain. So JC, I'm giving you homework. If you're listening to this before we spoke to you, then you know, uh-oh.
So we're going to go ahead and crack this baby open because my, what an open with this episode.
Well, we open with like, and this is why I said like we're breaking fifth wall territory now. We open with like a television sitcom.
Yes.
It actually reminded me a little bit of Roseanne at first.
Yeah, I can see that.
The way there's a little boy and a mom and a dad, but then it goes straight Leave It to Beaver and becomes extremely, extremely wholesome.
Yeah.
But of course, that can't stand on Freddy's nightmares.
So let's get into it. The episode opens as we are in a nice family-sized kitchen looking over a family-sized kitchen, as opposed to a fun-sized kitchen,
which is like much smaller, but you can enjoy it on the go.
Mom, dad, son, and dog. The little boy asks his parents, where do babies come from?
Dog, by the way?
That dog is not real, for one.
The dog is frozen in space. That dog appears to be fake, if not stuffed.
They've got a taxidermy dog on a table, and it's just sitting there hauntingly.
Really
so the little boy asks his parents, where do babies come from? While pouring his son cereal, the dad tells his son, it's kind of a complicated story, but he begins that there is first a magic stork. The mother adds, then comes the bees, the daisies, and then mother and father begin to embrace each other, continuing with snips, snails, and puppy dog tails.
Ah, yes.
The two laugh as we cut to Freddy, who is in his domain, watching this on his TV, and Freddy comments, you whiny yuppies, you call that a story? He chucks his bowl of popcorn at the TV and comments, I'll give you a story. Suddenly, the TV family freezes as a title reading, Freddy Something, pops up, of course, mocking the famous sitcom 30 Something.
Yes, and boy does it. I'm surprised they didn't, they must have been showing some restraint because they didn't show like a close-up of the popcorn bowl with like bugs and stuff in it. I was actually waiting for it.
Yeah. So, the stinger from Freddy's Nightmares appears with Freddy Something. He continues while holding a curved dagger, but first, let's deal with Daddy. He then flings the knife into the TV, right into the father's back, who falls over, letting out a, you see, son, that's where babies come from, before now, falling dead on the table and then the floor.
And you call it a curved dagger, but I don't think that's really correct.
What is it?
Well, because a curved dagger tends to be to curved
the,
one
the
way.
One way, yeah.
No, this dagger was zigzag.
Zigzag.
It was... I there's got to be a word for it that I'm not remembering, but like it literally, it's like Z's of sharp deadliness. And yeah, it just sticks right into
sticks
the old
right
man's
into him.
Back. Just like when you decided not to get a full degree in college, that knife in your dad's back.
The parents stuck that knife in my back, but that's here. That's another story.
Look at Dave over here. I have a dad complaining.
The family continues. Going about breakfast till Freddy interrupts again, holding a noose this time and stating, yo mama, what a crock. Lassos the noose into the TV as it drops into frame. He suddenly pulls it, hanging the mother, killing her. Next, he dons a bow and arrow, stating, fetch, Fido. Well,
he doesn't just... So he swings a
swings
noose,
the lasso,
like it's
the
a lasso,
noose into the TV.
It's a noose.
Yeah.
And then it drops from
it
the
drops
ceiling,
into frame.
And then when he pulls it, he's like the hunchback from Notre Dame.
Just ringing the bell.
Like, he grabs it, he's like, ha-ha! And he like jumps down. It is some of the most totally chaotic Freddy. Like, Freddy hasn't been this ridiculous since the time it just cut to him stabbing that power box
with his
glove.
And we'll get to it, but the cutaways directly to Freddy in this episode with
so good.
So, takes a bow and arrow, shoots the dog, and shoots the arrow into the dog's head, and with a yelp, it falls on the table. The little boy watches this as lights begin to flicker in the kitchen. The kids show signs of nervousness, watching them flash, as we cut back to Freddy, who comments, "Aw, whittle kid's afraid of the dark. Now that's something I can make a story out of." We then cut back to the kitchen as the wall slides open with a dark, smoky hallway. Mikey, the little boy who's played by Jamie McCann, he comes to Freddy's Nightmares having done Webster in 1985. He's in the James Wood films in Love and War in 87, Remote Control, and Henrik. He was also Gage in Munchie and Munchie Strikes Back.
All right. So we got a real actor.
We do.
I want to point out, first of all, the way Freddy said that suggests to me that the way he terrorizes you in your dreams is like an art form. He's like, I can really make a story out of this.
Yeah.
So that's number one. Number two, was anyone else's palms getting sweaty at the idea that Freddy's alone with this little boy?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
100%.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Because like, I was like, well, he's going to kill the kid. Because like, if he kills the kid, that's a hell of an opening, just killing the whole family.
Well, I mean,
wouldn't be the first.
No, it would not be.
So, Mikey sits at the table for a second, picks up his flashlight along with his toy commando gun. And when I say a toy commando gun, this is a stacked fucking little rifle he has.
It looks like a real gun.
Yeah.
No, I think it was supposed to, because it's a dream, obviously. Yeah. I mean, he didn't just happen to actually live in a sitcom and then Freddy, you know...
You're making assumptions about that kid's life.
Freddy TiVo'd his parents dead. It looks like a real... I think it was a real gun.
So he ventures towards the tunnel and he starts calling out hello as he approaches the abyss. Where is everybody? It's too dark in here. He keeps commenting as he makes his way down.
I commented the same thing. It's too dark in here because... It's really dark. You could barely see
anything. So in the tunnel, we can only barely make out Mikey and his and some flashing as he moves further through the tunnel, not getting any light appearing the further he goes. He suddenly hears a growling sound and comments, right, naturally, and proceeds towards it when suddenly screams and drops out of frame. We then cut to a close-up of adult Mikey, who's played by David Arnott. He was Banana in House 2, the second story.
Well, first of all, David Arnott?
Is it?
How do you say it?
Arnott.
David Arnott?
Yeah, A-R-N-O-O-T, or O-T-T.
It's a weird name, dude. Yeah. Jesus Christ. I wasn't questioning your accuracy. I meant, like, so when they're casting, they were like, let's go with David Arnott. Well, gee, if you're not really sold on it, then we could go with someone else. No, David Arnott.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah, or not, I guess. Like, if it's between him or not, I don't feel like you're really into this person. The casting director's like, I give up. And it's like, well, who else do you want to go with? He was like, that young kid over there, louder. Who do you want to go with next? All right, anyway. So
he plays Banana in House 2, the second story. He's in Three Fugitives, did The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, Mad About You, ER, and the one that I save for last, he's a screenwriter for Last Action Hero along with Shane Black.
Okay, so first of all, I want you to unpack those again.
Yeah.
Because I got very distracted by the last two.
So he is in Three Fugitives. Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Okay.
Mad About You, the TV show.
Oh, okay.
ER, the TV show. And he's the screenplay writer for Last Action Hero, along with Shane Black.
Did he have any other screenwriting credits?
No, that was the only one.
That's really interesting. It's also interesting you said Adventures in Ford Fairlane.
Ford Fairlane, yeah.
Because JC wrote that,
yes.
And Rennie Harlan directed it.
Yeah.
And that's the director of Nightmare on Elm Street 4. It's very interesting how it all interconnects.
Oh yeah. Like in doing this show and looking at filmographies, the shows that cross over with Freddy's Nightmares a lot, include Saint Elsewhere, Dark Justice. What's the one I'm blanking on right now?
Any Star Trek?
I can't remember. I mean, all the Star Treks. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, what you're doing is you're just listing out working actors gigs.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it goes. That's why I know I've pointed out to you that you can tell where a movie or TV show is filmed by who the side cast members are, because they'll be like, oh, these are all people that live in New York. Like,
yeah.
Like, cause when you watch Oz, it's nothing but New York character actors. So then you're watching like Spider-Man and it's like, oh, that side character's that guy. And that side character's that guy. And you're like, oh, they must be shooting in New York, you know, or Toronto, which is near New York. So that's a very, very similar kind of concept. Well, I'm the one who blew David's mind about movie trivia.
Yeah.
Because I pointed out to you that one of the most interesting things you can do when you watch any movie is click on the cinematographer.
Yep.
Because cinematographers, not only do they gotta work, but they work.
They
because
work.
Because every movie has to have a cinematographer.
You could do a whole podcast around DPs, like, for real.
I mean, that is an adult subject that I don't really feel comfortable covering, but I would.
It's a lie.
I would support you. If you wanted to do a podcast strictly about whoa. Jeez, David. It's a family show.
Is it?
Well, yeah, and how do you make a family?
Hey.
Bye.
So, adult Mikey has fallen out of bed to the floor from his nightmare. Linda, his girlfriend, who was played by Dana Stevens, she was in China Beach in 1989, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and going back to screenwriters, she's also the writer of City of Angels, For the Love of the Game, Safe Haven, and The Woman King.
When you say City of Angels, do you mean the Good Crow movie?
No, you just hurt me.
But is that the Good Crow movie?
No, I mean the Nicolas Cage movie.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's cool too.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you meant the Good Crow movie.
Shut it.
Wait, so The Woman King?
The Woman King. That was one of her most recent things on her resume, was she was a story contributor.
Is it? I mean, she does have writing credits. Sometimes I wonder if these are like misattributed.
That could be the same name. Yeah.
Especially the gentleman, the actor, because it's like, why would he only have one writing credit? I mean, I'm just saying, because IMDb can misattribute it a lot, but it's
really cool.
Well,
Linda asks him if he's all right. Mikey composes himself and gets back up on the bed, telling her he had a really weird dream about a kid trapped in a tunnel with a creature coming after him. He goes on before asking Linda what time it is, and Linda comments, it's noon. Michael responds with, that would explain the bright lights in the big sky.
That would explain the big bright light in the sky.
Yeah.
Well, I want to point out what she should have said. It's time to get a job. Anyway, because we're getting there.
Linda comments, gives up, to which Michael dorkily replies, "Hey, I win." Linda tells him, dorkily replies, yes. Okay, that's okay. What I wrote.
I was acknowledging it, not judging it.
You were doing both.
Well, I mean,
your acknowledgement is judgment.
Louis, I apologize.
Mm-hmm. I bet you do. So Linda tells him he knows what she means, commenting on he watches TV all night, sleeps all day, and watches TV in the afternoon. Michael yawns and states that sometimes he also goes to the movie, which doesn't amuse her. Linda continues that he needs to get a job to think about his future, and Michael comments that he's struck out of 100 job interviews.
Do you notice the table she's making lunch at is like 5 feet tall? Yeah. Like, he looks like a midget.
Oh, don't worry.
Compared to that.
We'll get to their bedroom here in a second and talk about that, too.
But yeah, he's like way down low. But I also want to point out, how can you not find a job when Springwood literally has the largest economy on Earth?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just literally every industry is in Springwood.
It's funny you mention that, because we're about to meet another business in Springwood, the one that I fell in love with the moment they showed us. So Linda apologizes that she doesn't mean to nag, kissing him goodbye, adding that Murray, the boss from hell, only gives them 15 minutes for lunch as she leaves. Michael picks up a newspaper, finding a listing stating, "Great job, great hours, great pay, and great future." He laughs and puts down the paper, but hesitates before picking it back up. We then cut to an exterior of Springwood Video.
Oh,
as
you
we cut inside,
heard that right.
Oh yeah, as we cut inside to see a woman browsing the shelves, landing on a film called Crabmen from Venus, she holds up the tape to Linda, asking if this is good. Linda begins to tell her true feelings, but is interrupted by the video store owner, Murray, played by Stephen Keats. He was in Death Wish in 74, Silent Rage in 82, The A-Team in 84, and Miami Vice. He had a large resume, a lot of TV stuff for this guy. He tells the customer, "It's a sci-fi classic. It's got monsters like you wouldn't believe. Blood, gore, guts, slime, rape, pillage, you name it, it's got it." The customer replies, shocked, "What? I have small children." To which Murray adds, "And yet, it's a real family film. I mean, charming, poignant, heartwarming. It's about a boy and his crabs. $3 a day and have it back by 11 tomorrow."
I love this video store clerk, because she accepts it. She's like, "All right." And she gives him $3. And all I could think was like, I love this guy. Like, I could just see him right now. Like, come on, kids love animals. Cannibal Holocaust, $3.
So Murray takes out his breath freshening spray, gives a couple pumps into his mouth, making his way over Linda, asking her about joining him for dinner, a little jacuzzi, maybe even some late night satellite dish TV.
Ooh, late night satellite dish TV. I also want to point out, you know how you could tell that Louis is not very old?
Huh.
You said breath spray instead of Banaka spray.
I didn't write Banaka.
You're not that old.
Oh, I know what Banaka is. I just didn't
write
it.
I'm sure you know, but it's not like you used the Banaka
no,
spray.
I have not.
For those who don't know, Banaka, it was the name brand of breath spray that was most popular for most of the 80s and 90s. And that, so a lot of people would just call it a Banaka spray for spraying your mouth. Most famous example I could think of somebody saying Banaka spray is in the pharmacy scene in the remake of The Blob.
Yeah.
Where he says, "I'll have a pack of condoms and Banaka spray. So you did not say Banaka spray because you are not as close to death as me.
I mean, I have no comment to that.
I mean, Death and I hang out all the time.
So, watching from the middle of the store, another assistant angrily looks towards Murray, who tells Linda, "Don't listen to that slime." An entry doorbell chimes as Michael enters the store dressed in a nice suit. He walks up to Linda at the counter, telling her to congratulate him because he got a job.
Yeah, hand job at a bus station.
Linda congratulates him, asking where, and Michael tells her he saw an ad in the paper for a great job, so he called it up and got hired. He kisses her bye as we join him on the street outside an office complex in Springwood. Michael approaches the building, but is stopped by a man who calls him over. Michael, thinking the man is homeless, apologizes, stating he doesn't have anything to offer him because he's nearly homeless himself. The man introduces himself as the one who he spoke to on the phone, hired him, telling him he is Al Kanan, Lord of the Underworld, and ladies and gentlemen, Al Kanan, played by Dick Miller.
My first question, how did he not recognize Dick Miller's voice?
I don't know. I don't know.
Now, everybody, get ready, because David has agreed. I'm sorry, Louis. No, I'll tell you what. If you come through on this,
okay,
I will drop the Louis bit.
Oh God.
And I will call you David.
The pressure's on.
Just name every appearance.
Every appearance.
Not going to be hard on you. every feature film appearance.
185 credits on IMDb.
And they are.
So, starting, no, I'm kidding. We have Gremlins, of course, the Burbs, the Terminator. He gets killed by Schwarzenegger in the gun shop.
You can't do that here.
Wrong.
Bam.
Night of the Creeps. I mean, if you don't know who Dick Miller is, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast.
He was featured in the documentary, That Guy Dick Miller, because
phenomenal.
He's one of those that guys. Similar to that documentary, That Guy Who's in the Thing. You remember that? Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't, but I know
about
it.
It's a documentary about character actors. Because character actors, for those who don't know, I mean, first of all, in show business, male character actors and female character actors. If you're a male and you're called a character actor, it means you're ugly. If you're a female and you're called a character actor, it means you're old. That is, that is not me saying that's how it should be.
Yeah.
That is me telling you.
How it is.
That is how it is. Like, here's a good example. William H. Macy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a phenomenal actor. He's not a terrible looking guy,
mm-mm.
But he isn't a traditionally attractive man.
No, he's not a leading man usually.
Well, so if he popped up like in, what's that Stuart Gordon movie we watched with him?
Oh, Edmund.
Edmund. When he pops up as the main character, there's a little something off in your mind that you're like, what? Like that, but it's subconscious.
Yeah.
It's not like you start the movie and you go, William H. Macy can't star in a movie, but you do see him and you're like, oh, he's the... Okay, let's see what his life is like. You know, you're
terrible. If you haven't seen Edmund, his life is terrible.
Phenomenal film. But but that's like that's been a real thing.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, when an actress gets to a certain age and they start becoming they go from being an ingenue to being kind of like the matriarch of families or whatever, like kind of like Jamie Lee Curtis has been doing for the last 10 years or so, that's considered character roles, because character roles, I'm making air quotes, are not starring roles.
Yeah.
They're roles that are where your job isn't to be you, your job is to become somebody else that's pointed to the story.
Yeah.
And those tend to be ugly people or old people or fat people. And this is, again, this is not me saying, and thank goodness for show business. I also like all the sexual violence in show business. That is not my point. My point is I'm simply giving you history and a historical basis. And Dick Miller is one of those incredible examples of a very, very successful that guy character, because he'd pop up in Gremlins. You'd be like, oh, that guy.
That guy.
And then he'd pop up in Terminator. You go, oh, that guy. The only other person I can think of who I think deserves that level of love, because the other thing is, and this is the part I don't love about Dick Miller's career. I mean, I loved Dick Miller. He passed away not too long ago.
R.I.P.
But the big thing that I hated was that he never really got a big starring role outside of the early days of his career with Roger Corman. Unlike people like William H. Macy or where they got like bigger roles. So if I had to pick an exact person to be like him, who is as famous for being that guy, it would have to be Buck Flower.
Yeah. Oh, you're 100% on that.
And they both have this thing about them, but they're completely the opposite. Buck Flower looks like he's from Arkentucky, Louisiana. And
facts.
Now, for those who are like, who's Buck Flower? Remember in Back to the Future, crazy drunk drivers, crazy drunk pedestrian. It's him. But he very seldom wasn't just that walk-on guy.
Yeah.
He had a few moments. John Carpenter was great to him in They Live. He got like a lot to chew on. But
so,
you know,
good.
I would call They Live Buck Flower's
starring.
Gremlins.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, not like starring, Gremlins for Dick Miller.
Yeah. Because
Dick Miller got a real role in both the Gremlins movies.
Yeah.
He wasn't just showing up. But Bruce Dern's another good example.
Yes.
Bruce Dern's still killing it, but he very seldom gets his big roles. When he was younger, he did.
Yeah.
But he definitely became character actor. Like, the moment he could be a crotchety old man, he was one of the best crotchety old
100%.
Men in show business. Have you ever seen Nebraska?
I freaking love Nebraska.
Okay.
Such
anyway, well, we're going to stop. But I just wanted to say all of that because if you're not familiar with Dick Miller or you're not familiar with the concept of a character actor, he is quintessential. So talented, but unlike Buck Flower, who was like that, well, he's from the hills of somewhere, was the way you saw him with Dick Miller, New York.
Yeah.
He's just 100%. A New York guy in everything he does.
And he made the terror make sense.
Yeah, because he literally
explains
the entire plot. and he was supposed to be deaf and mute. Anyway, I love the terror. So
good.
So Dick Miller, is there anything else you want
to
say about
him? No, so we'll go back to the story. So he meets Al, played by Dick Miller. He tells Michael to follow him to a city worker tent, but Michael insists that there must be some mistake. Al tells him no mistakes and to come on. Inside the tent, Al drinks a beer while telling Michael to take off his clothes.
Yeah.
Taken aback by that.
Wait.
There we go. Taken aback by that request, he asks why. Michael questions, and Al points down to a chained-off manhole, saying, "That's where you're going to be working," while holding up rubber coveralls.
Oh, yeah.
Down in the sewer, Al and Michael walk down a tunnel as Al gives him a rundown of the job and mainly the importance of sewers with disease control being a factor.
Yeah, and Springwood sewers, David.
Yeah.
Didn't you just the other day while we were having dinner say you were really curious about the sewage system under Springwood?
100%. I can't believe you remembered that.
No, I listen sometimes when you're not talking about yourself.
That's fair.
Because when you're talking about yourself, it's sad.
So cutting back to the tent real quick, did you appreciate how it was kind of like Miller's man cave? Like he had a lawn chair.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it totally
I was waiting for like a pinball machine, yeah. A neon beer sign.
Yeah, it's just a neon, but the neon beer sign literally just said beer.
Beer.
Like it didn't have a brand on it. It's just beer. We like to drink beer.
So down in the sewer, Al and Michael walk down the tunnel. Like I said, he gives him the rundown. Al tells him that he's going to have to look for cracks, smell for gas, look for blockages, plus, depending on the rainfall, have to check the valves and rechannel pipelines.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Check the valves.
Check the valves. Hey.
I don't know why. It's just, this is a very sexy episode, I guess.
Simplifying it, what he calls overflow control. The two continue down the tunnel as Al adds to be careful down here because it ain't a bowl of cherries, he says, joking, which I did love. Michael tells him, good one, your lordship. And Al continues that the centipedes aren't bad and the snakes aren't once he's going to build up immunity to the bites. But he tells him the alligators, what you got to watch out for.
Ah, the old alligators in the sewer. You know, Springwood really is just the best place for children to die prematurely.
Is.
Like, take that, Somalia.
So Michael doesn't think he's serious. So Al explains that the parents buy alligators for their kids at carnivals and pet shops, but they end up getting big, they end up getting loose, and they find shelter in the sewers with the lack of light. They eventually go all white. Michael mocks him, asking, albino alligators? Come on. Al insists to him not to laugh, stating that he's got the scar on his calf to prove it. Suddenly, the lights in the tunnel begin to flicker and electricity sounds off shorting. Michael latches onto Al in fear, causing Al to ask, what's the matter? Michael states that he has a fear of the dark, and Al laughs, telling him, that's something you'll have to get over fast.
Yeah, I love that. Well, that's something you have to get over fast.
He tells Mike to come on and walks down the tunnel. Michael calls to Al with no answer. He begins to run when suddenly he finds his head in the jaws of an albino alligator as he screams, trying to free himself.
And we cut to commercial.
That we do. So
when we come back, guys, back from commercial, he's just in his apartment.
Yes.
Explaining to his wife, like, this guy I work for is so weird. Yeah. Can you believe he has a giant fake albino alligator
that
head?
He uses on the rookies to initiate them?
That is the kind of thing, if I had that job, if I ran that company, I would be like, $700 for an albino alligator head? It's an investment. Here's my Discover card.
So we're in Michael's bedroom now, and this is what I was going to talk to you about.
The fireplace?
And why is the neon light, like, not anywhere around the perimeter of the room? It's just hanging above the fireplace and goes off. Like, you don't see where that light goes.
Yeah, there's an odd neon lightness, but the fireplace, folks, it's elevated off the ground.
Yes.
So it does not touch the ground.
No, it does not.
It doesn't look like a fireplace.
No, it does not.
It's just a window to hell.
It looks like a boiler.
It looks like you open the curtains and go, it's a particularly nice day in hell today. Oh, there's Dante. Quite an inferno you got there.
Just waiting for Freddy to pop out. Can you keep it down?
Keep it down. Some people are here trying to kill kids.
So Linda and Michael lay in bed. He tells him that he works for Al Kanan, Lord of the Underworld, and that he is as crazy as Henrik mentioned. Linda comments that she's only heard this half a dozen times today and goes to turn off the bedroom lights, making the room go dark till Michael, in a panic, flips them back on.
Oh my God. He was killing me.
Is great.
That actor's so funny.
You and I are both big fans of Your Honor. I thought he was the main gangster guy at first. He kind of looks like him a little bit.
You're stupid.
Fair. No, you gotta give me that.
He didn't remind me of him at all, but I was really impressed by his comedic timing.
Yeah. Because
he turns the lights back on and he's like, isn't this so nice?
Yeah.
You can just kind of see where you're sleeping, you know? It's great.
So he panic flips the light back on. He continues that Al owns a rubber alligator that he uses to haze the new recruits.
Wait, a rubber alligator?
Alligator.
Oh God, somebody kill me.
So he has a rubber alligator that he does the new recruits. Linda comments that he just has a sense of humor. She doesn't know why he's so concerned. Flips off the lights again. Michael flips them on again, telling her he's having a little trouble with the dark, like he's deathly afraid of it, to which Linda tells him he's acting like a little kid. Michael replies with he just spent a day in the dark with Mr. Wacko and his rubber pal, and that he's uneasy and he would just like a little coddling on his fear of the dark right now. Also stating that his job isn't glamorous, but it'll help pay the bills. Linda calms him down, telling him that working in the sewer is nothing to be ashamed of, as long as he takes a shower when he comes home before going in for a kiss, and she flips the light once again.
Hey, you know, it's not like it's a shit job or something.
Oh, wait.
Hey! Try the veal.
Michael flips the light on and tells her that that was cold. Linda laughs and tells him that she's got something that'll keep his mind off it and help him sleep as she goes in for another kiss, embracing him, turning off the lights again. Michael flips the switch again and asks, couldn't we do this with the lights on? The two begin to make out as Linda finally pulls the switch out of the wall, creating a short in the outlet, and the room cuts to dark as we hear the sound of a heartbeat start.
I like how it's like, this is marriage, folks. I am so tired of you trying to get what you want. There goes our security deposit. Oh, that got to Dave.
God damn it.
That got to him.
We are back in the very dark tunnel with little Mikey as he continues exploring, commenting out loud that his mother said it's just his imagination and there's nothing to fear. As he comes to the end of the tunnel, commenting, easy for her to say.
Yeah, well, you know what's really the most scary thing?
What's that?
The unknown.
Yes.
Which is what we're experiencing because I cannot see a goddamn thing in
again.
This tunnel. And I want to mention, so Freddy's Nightmares, we like to joke about it, but this is the best it can look.
Yes.
And it doesn't look great.
No.
It was shot on, I believe it was 16 millimeter film.
Yeah.
It was transferred to videotape in the 80s. And that's it.
Yeah.
So the episodes already are dark.
Yeah.
They're on the darker side picture wise. And like when Dave will send me like a screen grab or something for social media from the episodes, I always have to brighten them.
Same.
Because they're so dark. So these scenes where it's supposed to be pretty dark, it's like almost totally black.
Yeah, you can barely see. Yeah. You can see like the outline of a human if you're lucky.
Yeah, well, it's a child, not a human.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Suddenly he begins screaming as we cut back to Michael, who's screaming in bed, panicking next to Linda. He immediately flips the switch while hyperventilating.
Whoa. You good?
Say something?
Testing.
Oh, there you are. Sorry, technical difficulties, folks.
All right. Bitch. So he begins hyperventilating, commenting that he likes the room lit. It makes it a lot brighter, and Linda comments that this has to stop before rolling back over as Michael grabs two flashlights, turning them on, and holding them to his face for protection.
And this is at this point that I really love this guy.
I do,
He's
too.
So funny. And his lines are hilarious.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
just so kitschy. And like, I really was waiting for him to say, like, try the veal.
Yeah.
You know, because he had so many jokes that I was really enjoying.
So the next morning, Al and Michael are back on the job in the tent as Al is going over schematics of the sewer, telling him there's a major blockage in one of the pipes in the old part of town that hasn't been checked out in a few years. He tells Michael that he just needs to open the backup valve for a clean flush and he's home free. Michael responds with a clean flush. I got it. Making his way over to the manhole. He looks back at Al sitting on a lounger, asking him if he's joining. Al tells him he's going solo today and to have fun as he sits back with a newspaper. In the tunnel, Michael walks down doing impressions from the Honeymooners, calling himself a babbling Billy.
The only disappointment I have with this entire episode
yeah.
is when he said, like, you're going solo today.
Yeah.
He should have picked up like a copy of Swank or something. That was the only moment I was like, JC, if you're listening to this and you wrote that part, it should have been a copy of Swank. Would have been even funnier if it had just been a magazine with nothing other than the word Swank.
Swank.
Like, it didn't even have, like, a chick on it. It was just Swank.
So Babbling Billy is what he calls himself as he's walking, trying to calm himself, stating it's just a walk on the beach until he steps into a puddle and makes a really funny face.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man.
He gets to a point of the tunnel where he finds a hatchway, commenting he's never seen that before. Suddenly, his flashlight crackles and goes out, leaving him nearly in the dark as the lock on the door begins to spin, opening it up to reveal a bright red light with a monstrous hand coming out from behind it
oh,
as
man.
We cut to commercial
and
again.
I was getting some serious Are You Afraid of the Dark vibes.
Oh, yeah.
off of that. Although I guess, Are You Afraid? What I mean is, many times Are You Afraid of the Dark has given me some serious Freddy Nightmares vibes. But, or even Tales from the Dark Side vibes, like just because it was like super long fingernail thing reaching across the yada yada.
So Michael returns up top, going manic on Al, telling him about the hatchway and the thing that came out of it. Al tries to calm him down before screaming, "Hold it!" giving Michael a second to compose himself. Al asks him if he got the valve open, and Michael screams that he did not. Al tells him not to worry and it'll be okay as long as it doesn't rain and there's overflow. Michael tries to talk to him again, but Al interrupts him, telling him to go home. Michael stares back at him for a second before walking off, and then Al walks over to the rubber albino alligator, commenting, "I don't know, this one's wound up pretty tight, huh, Ralphie?" While he strikes a Quint-like pose, positioning himself to stand right in front of the gator's mouth as it's open.
Yeah, I definitely appreciated that gag.
He turns to watch Michael, who begins to run home. We cut back to a dark tunnel and hear little Mikey say, "Okay, that's it. Come and get me, sucker." Suddenly, we're back in the bedroom with the couple as Linda tells Michael that it's either her or the lights as he lays next, hyperventilating to her again. Michael tells her that he's going nuts, and she comments she's sympathetic, but he kept her up all night before and she needs to get sleep tonight before turning off the lights and trying to calm him down, telling him it's fine and she's here. The two lay in bed together for a couple seconds before he turns the light back on, upsetting Linda, who gets out of bed saying, "That's it," commenting he's a 25-year-old man who shouldn't be afraid of the dark. He's a grown man, and Michael begs her to stay, but Linda gets dressed, leaves, telling him goodbye. As the door slams, a thunderstorm echoes as lightning flashes outside the bedroom window and the power goes out. Michael then hears Al's voice repeat in his head, "It'll be okay as long as it doesn't rain." Michael then pulls a shotgun out from under his bed, holding it in his hands before rising off the bed as more lightning flashes this entire time. He cocks the gun and begins to laugh hysterically. So he's doing fine.
What I would say is he's doing great, at least by like Larry Tierney standards.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, like I think he's doing great.
So we get a hysterically laughing Michael. The next day, Michael and Al are under the tent as Michael sits outside the manhole loading his shotgun. Al comments with his headphones on, "Hey, kiddo, it rained last night." To which Michael replies, "Valve, old tunnel, I'm on it. Clean flush." Before cocking the gun and raising it ready for action, Michael then suddenly drops into the manhole with his screams echoing as he falls down. Al, reading his newspaper with his headphones on, doesn't notice a thing as he sits back. In the tunnel, the gun hits the ground, and we see Michael round a corner of red light towards the hatchway again. He approaches the hatchway and the hatchway opens, revealing a red mist room, but it's empty inside. Michael questions what the hell and comments he's getting out of here, turning around and running right into the monster's hand, who grabs his head, yanking him off to the side. We then see the end of the gunfire, but nothing else. Michael lays unconscious on the ground as someone picks up his shotgun unseen. They walk over to him, nudging him with the gun awake. And when I say nudging him with the gun, they're pointing the barrel directly at his head.
Literally, how else do you wake up? Like, remember the time you took a nap on my couch once for 20 minutes?
And you hit
how
me.
Did I wake you up?
Yeah, with a gun.
Yeah. Would you have woken up otherwise? No, you wouldn't have.
Michael comes to and sees little Mikey in front of him. Mikey asks if he's all right, and Michael says he thinks so before asking, "What the hell is that thing?" motioning to the monster. Little Mikey tells him, "It's the thing in your closet, the monster under your bed. It's whatever you're afraid of." So clearly it's Pennywise.
Why?
We're in the sewer.
We need to talk about your sexual attraction to Pennywise.
We're in the sewer, and it embodies whatever you're afraid of. I'm just saying.
I like that it was childlike, and I don't appreciate your erection right now.
I love this scene like so much, though. Like their interaction between each other is so sweet.
You know what's the saddest part, though?
What?
Is that like when he was a little boy, he was afraid of things in the dark, and they're like, "Well, but they can't hurt you." But now as an adult, it's like, "Well, Freddy Krueger's a friggin' thing now, so..." So bad news, when you were a kid and your mom said, "Dreams can't hurt you," she was right. But now, awkward.
Mikey tells him it's whatever you're afraid of. Michael then asks the kid who he is, and Mikey replies with Michael Bowman. Michael tells him that he's Michael Bowman, and the two ask one another how they got each other's guns. As Michael stands up, holding the commando rifle from the opening, the two swap their weapons as Michael tells Mikey little kids shouldn't play with guns, but little Mikey responds back with, "Adults shouldn't be afraid of the dark."
That kid. is going places.
He also adds that if he really is him all grown up, he can't believe what a geek he's going to be.
Man.
Michael asks him, does he think growing up is like playing a Nintendo game? Little Mikey thinks for a second before telling him that their mother says that they have to face their fears. Michael confirms, saying that she's right. Mikey then hands over his ball cap to Michael, telling him it's for good luck, and apologizes about the geek crack. Before he walks off, little Mikey asks him, when he gets older, do we finally get the girls? Michael grins, telling him, yeah, and Mikey adds, worth the wait? Michael then tells him yes again. Mikey walks off into the hatchway entrance as we hear Michael's inner monologue stating, clean flush. We come back to inside the tent as Michael is being loaded onto a gurney by paramedics covered in grime and hysterically laughing while telling Al he got a clean flush.
Another one for Weston Hills, kids.
Al tells him to take it easy and that he's done a good job.
Oh,
they,
yeah.
They cart Michael off in the ambulance as Al notices little Mikey's ball cap on the ground. He calls to the ambulance, but it's too late. Al then puts on his hat, stating that it wasn't a fall. It was the albino alligators. Gets them every time. The A story ends as we cut to another open manhole with steam escaping from it. Freddy rises halfway, stating, there's nothing to fear but fear. Trust me. He laughs, but suddenly screams as he's pulled down, and suddenly a white albino alligator emerges from the manhole with Freddy's hat in its mouth, belches, and sinks back down.
And that is the end of the A story. And I didn't mention it at the start of the show because Louis did not remind me.
What?
But we are watching this on Tubi TV.
That is correct.
And you should be checking it out on Tubi TV if you're in the United States, because you can watch it for free with commercials. And, you know, if you're at Tubi TV,
yeah,
why not watch a brand new anthology TV series called Found Footage, the series. It is created by me.
Yeah.
And I directed two of the episodes.
I'm in one of them.
That's not been confirmed in a court of law. And you should really check it out. It's at Tubi.tv or Tubi, T-U-B-I, on your favorite app. Or your favorite platform, whatever, Roku, yada, yada. But you should check it out. It's completely free to watch. But also, that's where we're watching Freddy's Nightmares. So as far as B stories go, for the uninitiated, on Freddy's Nightmares, they had A and B stories. But they weren't like traditional A and B stories. No, no, no.
No, no.
No, no. They were split right down the middle, where the A story was the first half and the B story was the second half. And often, as is the case with this episode, the B story has the lead character, B, a small character from the first episode. Sadly, not Dick Miller.
I know. I was so hoping. But what we get is pretty good. But before we get into the B story, I do want to talk about the TV breaks again. My favorite shot from the TV break was the one where they imposed Freddy next to Dick Miller.
And then the alligator. They just imposed the alligator over him, too.
It looked like like coming this fall on Fox.
Yeah, I mean, in the 90s, it would have been on Fox. So, I mean, there's no doubt.
So the B story begins as we are outside, boys and girls, that's right, Springwood Video.
That's right.
A homeless woman fishes through a shopping cart, pulling up a banana and biting into it. But inside the store, Murray is being chastised by a teenager for not having the film Royal Blood.
Well, wouldn't you be mad?
Murray tells the kid if he ain't got it, he ain't got it, and he can't go to someone's house and just take it back. The kid tells Murray that's fine, and it'll have his mom drop him off at another stupid video place. Murray grabs the kid as he's walking out and tells him, try this, handing him a VHS tape of Chainsaw Bikers, telling him it'll knock his socks off. The kid argues, but Murray goes on to tell him, it's Babes and Bazookas. You can't lose.
And I love, by the way, as if Freddy's Nightmares doesn't bring you enough nostalgia.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hanging out in the video store, pretty all right with me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he tells him that Babes and Bazookas, he can't lose. Takes the tape out of his hand, puts the money into Murray's hand, and Murray asks him if he wants to come work for him. But the kid responds with, he makes more than him with his allowance, and his parents are cheap. Murray tells him, don't forget to rewind, as he turns around to see a frantic Linda coming to the desk. He asks her where she's been, which she responds that she's been in the hospital, that Michael had an accident, and he's really messed up. Hearing this, Murray comments, oh, lover boy's out of action, and goes to touch Linda, but she tells him to back off, Toad, and leave her alone. Murray questions, ah, Toad, want to play leapfrog? As he puts a cigar in his mouth, taking a puff. Linda hands Murray the phone, telling him it's for you, and Murray takes the phone. Oh, did I miss one?
You left out the part where he said, I like a little resistance when I'm laying pipe.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, I did not catch that. Holy shit.
Because my note to that was, what the fuck did he just say?
I missed
something
that.
He said something along the lines of, I like a little resistance, or I like a whatever when I'm
laying
pipe.
Was that after leapfrog?
it was before that.
Okay. I must have missed that then.
Well, you only watch them twice.
Shut up.
But dead serious.
Yeah.
Literally, that's all my note says. What the fuck did he just say?
Well, then that plays into the next part because Linda hands Murray the phone telling him it's for you. Murray takes the phone to hear the other end state, sexual harassment hotline, may I help you?
Which is truly.
That's a boss move.
Nah, that's a truly sick burn. So, well played.
He hangs up on the sexual harassment hotline, and we see the homeless woman enter the store. Murray berates the security guard, played by Kenyatta Pui, for looking at adult title rather than watching the door. The guard apologizes as Murray literally starts kicking the woman out the door. A black gentleman enters and walks into the store, introducing himself to Murray as Raymond Jordan from Black Knight Audio. He is played by Stephen Burks, who is in Grabo Talks, St. Elsewhere, Cheers, Murphy Brown. Guy's done a lot of TV stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Asking if he's got a minute. Murray tells him he's a busy man, but Raymond interrupts, stating he's a collector for Black Knight Audio, and he owes them a lot of money for the self-help audio cassettes he advanced him. Murray laughs, stating that he's in the video cassette business now, and asks if Raymond can show him a contract. Raymond tells him he cannot because Murray already sold the cassettes, and the contract was simply a handshake.
For those of you who are very, very young, there was a time when you rented audio tapes.
Yes.
And records.
Yes.
And that's it. That's all I got.
That's all you got?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't alive during that time, but there was a time when you rented
them. Cassette tapes in the library growing up.
Did they rent music?
Yeah.
Oh, mine only rented books on tape.
Oh, yeah. Ours had a lot. So Murray already sold the cassettes and the contract was simply a handshake. Murray clicks his tongue against his teeth and states, art of the deal, Mr. Jordan, art of the deal, and walks off as Raymond comments, so that's how it is. Raymond walks over to join Murray at his desk, which is just a desk in the back of the video store. Not an office, literally in the tapes. Yeah,
just in the middle of the aisles, right next to a cutout for Big.
A cutout for Big, a Krite stand-up for Critters 2.
Yes.
And a standee for Bright Lights Big City, and there was another one. I loved being in this video store. I was looking at all the tapes on the shelves the entire time.
But did any of those other standees involve a grown woman having sex with a child?
Oh my God, when you and I revisited Big a year ago, it really traumatized us.
What? It was it was a fun, quirky experience of her having sex with a child in an adult's body. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Raymond meets him at his desk. He slides a tape across the desk to him called How to Be a Mega Success, adding or your money back. Murray laughs, asking if this is a joke, but Raymond goes on to explain that it's a prototype for subliminal messaging tape to help activate the innate talent of the person who uses it while sleeping. Because that doesn't sound scary.
Well, there were a lot of those things supposed to listen to when you sleep that would like stop smoking, stop being David, whatever like awful thing people didn't want to do anymore.
He encourages Murray to use it tonight before he goes to bed, stating that with his knowledge of handling money, he could wake up tomorrow and become a rich man beyond his wildest dreams. Murray questions at it, stating that he's a busy man, and he asks Raymond, what's the hook? Raymond tells him maybe he'll square the bill and carry the lineup of tapes, and holds out his hand. Murray thinks for a few seconds before asking, no strings? And Raymond confirms no strings as the two strike a deal over a handshake.
You left out the fabulously wealthy part, but otherwise that was a solid recap.
We immediately cut to a close-up of Freddy, and when I say cut to a close-up, we just slice right to it.
It's just Freddy now, guys.
A poem by Freddy Krueger. I once met a guy who was a sleaze, whose throat I slit with much ease. He thought he had smarts till I cut off his parts, and then all he had left was a bleep. Freddy then gets angry and shouts, hey, bleep this, son of a... He scoffs before holding up the tape of How to Be a Mega Success before throwing the tape over his shoulder.
Now, this is what I mean when I said fifth wall breaking.
Yeah.
So now Freddy is not only aware there's an audience, but he's aware he's on broadcast television and can be bleeped.
And present us with poetry.
Freddy, we know that Freddy is a poet.
I know.
He just didn't be aware of it.
I hate you.
Yeah, me too.
So he throws the tape over his shoulder. The tape then falls into the shot on Murray's nightstand as he readies for bed. He puts the tape into his player and begins playing it before laying down on the bed. A voice on the tape welcomes him to the program, telling him that all his dreams could become reality. The voice instructs him to start by closing his eyes and now visualize the most important thing in his life. Murray closes his eyes and comes to a bright red room when suddenly two figures rise alongside the bed. Murray with joy exclaims, Mommy? Daddy? The father removes his glasses, asking his wife, where did they go wrong? Murray questions wrong as his dad states they failed him. Murray argues that he's a success, but his mom interrupts, you're a butt, son. Plain and simple.
I love it said you're a butt.
Yeah, you're a butt.
Because that was a thing my mom never really called me a butt. She probably did a couple times. But that was the thing my mom does that now I do, mostly to the dogs. I'll just be like, oh, well, he's being a butt now, so he's not going to eat his food. Or, oh, she's being a butt now, so she didn't bite David.
You're a butt, son. Plain and simple. Vicious, selfish, you're a low-down, lecherous slime ball. His dad adds that he's also a poor dresser with halitosis, and they comment he clearly lacked discipline on top of never eating his spinach or cleaning his room. Murray responds the two of them are dead and begins to spray more Banaka in his mouth.
Oh, now, did you write Banaka, or did you just...
I did not.
You just added it in because you wanted to be cool, the cool kids?
Yes.
Okay.
His mother comments that this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt us, son. The two spit on their hands and suddenly bring up axes, slamming them down.
They do the thing where you spit on your hands and rub them together, like you're trying to get friction.
So they bring up two axes, slamming them down onto Murray as he screams, but suddenly wakes up in bed.
No, they're hacking away at his crotch.
Yes, that is true.
I feel like
you can't. That's you can barely see it.
That's an important distinction, David.
But what's weird is later in the episode, he's got stitches on his neck, like they chopped his head off, and that's what was weird to me.
Yeah, but Freddy's made multiple references to the fact that
he cuts
the
his
guy's
dick off.
The guy's junk is
yes
is the goal.
So they cut his dick off, and Murray wakes up screaming.
I mean, cut his dick off is a little strong. They just chopped it. Finally, I would call it a julienne.
Sweaty and shaken, Murray asks, what was that all about? As he suddenly looks over to a woman who says, Murray, is that you? She rolls over in bed to him. Murray calls the woman Rebecca and tells her that he had the strangest dream about his parents lopping off before stopping and checking his body.
Yeah.
He laughs, but Rebecca reminds him he's a slime ball and they're not together as a man rises on the other side of her bed. Murray asks, who's Conan? Before the man drives a fist into Murray's face with a thud. Murray comes to in an alley, filthy and in pain, as the security guard from the store lays into him, calling him multiple names and telling him that he's tired of being bossed around.
It's just keep going.
Oh, God. Murray tries to reason with the guard, offering him more pay and a promotion, but the guard responds by opening up a large switchblade and pointing it right at Murray. Murray comes to again, even filthier this time, with broken teeth, laying on a bed under garish green lighting, sipping from a bottle, commenting that he plans to fire that security guard in the morning. Murray suddenly notices, though, that he's not himself. He looks a lot like the homeless woman from the beginning of the episode as he makes his way over to the mirror, looking in shock before falling back.
Oh, my God.
He comes to in his bedroom again and checks his face and teeth before making his way to another mirror. He comments, it was just a dream. But it's interrupted as Freddy's claws shatter the mirror, pulling him inside of it.
And that jump scare works.
Got me. It
scared
me.
Yeah. It scared me. So that was an actual functional jump scare in this episode.
And I'm trying to think what the TV break was in this one.
They were all just, it was like, a lot of them were him pulling on that rope all excited.
Oh, I remember what it is. He's in bed and Freddy is like in the domain next to him. Yeah.
It's so weird. So, and I gotta say, I mean, these dreams are out of control, even by Freddy's nightmare standards. I feel like, and I'm excited that we might get some insight into this, but I feel like it was almost like they wanted to take the trope of like waking up, but you're still dreaming to like the nth degree. They were like, let's take it as far as it can possibly go.
Oh boy, do we,
because here we go. So we come back to the commercial break.
So Murray comes to laying on the ground, but there are stars all around him. And when I say that there's stars, we had mentioned this earlier in the episode.
He's in space.
He's in space, but very bad space effects.
What would you say? Why would it be bad? You mean because it was terrible blue screen?
Yes, that would be why.
He's not just in space. He's in a car in space with what's his name?
Raymond's voice tells him, hello, Maggot, as Murray looks up to see Raymond peeking out behind a Corvette. Murray laughs, stating that he had him going there for a while with dream after dream. What a cool effect. Raymond interrupts, telling him he still doesn't get it, telling him that the dream doesn't stop until he says it does. He goes on saying that Murray lacks respect and he uses and hurts people with no consequences, but that can change. Raymond tells him he's going to help him change as he fires up the Corvette, dropping Murray out of frame with a scream as the engine roars to life. Murray comes to laying down with a hot wheel of the Corvette on the bridge of his nose. He removes it and sits up to see Raymond spin around in the chair laughing. Murray demands him to leave his dream and frantically begins to tell himself to wake up. Raymond reminds him that he will wake up when he wants him to, and Murray tries to deflect Raymond, saying he will him out of his mind and begins to go into a meditation pose almost.
Yeah, that guy looks like he knows how to line some chakras.
Raymond reminds him that, Raymond reminds him that he'll wake up when he wants him to, and Murray tries to deflect him. Raymond laughs and tells him to will him a pepperoni pizza before he explains that the tape is what has him trapped right now, calling it a bullet with his name on it. He encourages Murray to go with the flow, stating his subconscious is now his. Murray grabs the tape and destroys it, which makes Raymond laugh, stating that he only destroyed the dream tape. While he's stuck in the dream, the tape continues to roll on and
heavy.
On. Murray laughs and tells him, I lost place again. Murray screams uncle, saying he gives up, and grabs Raymond, asking him what does he want. Raymond tells him simply what he owes them: half the store, half his money, half of everything. Murray laughs and tells him no way, so Raymond tells him to have it his way and the Black Knight collectors will come and take it over from here. Raymond laughs as he leaves Murray, or Raymond leaves as Murray rushes the door, shutting it behind him, when suddenly a chainsaw sounds and cuts through the door.
Yes, yes. Oh, God. So...
Oh, we're getting wild.
Keep going. We're almost there.
Murray comes to with his alarm going off and birds chirping. He quickly sits up and ejects the tape, destroying it again and throwing it to the ground. He seems calm as he begins to look around the room. Approaching the door cautiously, he opens it to reveal nothing behind it but a graffitied brick wall, and begins to back away, slowly bumping into his mirror. He then runs to his window and climbs out in his pajama and socks, emerges into the daylight with sunken dark eyes and a bruised cheek. He walks at the end of his driveway before spraying more Banaka, but suddenly we see him repeat the same action again out the window, and he repeats this like 5 times.
Yes, he does.
Murray getting more and more burned out each time, the darker circles forming around his eyes. Suddenly, at the end of the block, a motorcycle fires up as a Black Knight begins to ride towards him, wielding a chainsaw. At the other end, a Black Knight on horseback also begins to charge him. Murray begins to freak out, sinks to his knees, crying out, he gives up. Uncle, surrendering and asking if he's happy. The white Corvette pulls into frame behind him as Raymond's evil laughter echoes from the car, asking him sarcastically, does he need a lift, before laughing more. Murray jumps into the car and they roll off. Driving through neighborhoods, Raymond asks him if he's had enough and agrees to the terms to pay them and sign over half his assets. Murray strongly expresses his agreement and begging him to wake up. The car is now suddenly in the sky when Raymond tells him to get out. Murray opens the door, falling out as Raymond laughs again. He falls back into his bedroom, awakening to the sound of the tape's music. He picks up the clock, commenting that all of that took only 25 minutes. He immediately picks up a pen and paper, writing out his declaration of him signing over half of everything to Ray Jordan and Black Knight Incorporated. He states he'll call the lawyer in the morning and that he's going to go to the store and everything will be cool, repeating this over a couple times, trying to convince himself. Before he leaves, he grabs the tape again from the player, destroying it and throwing it to the ground. And we cut to Springwood Video, where the security guard sits in the adult section, eating and watching a tape, enjoying himself.
Well, wouldn't you?
Murray rushes into the store, screaming, "It's me!" But the guard opens fire, shooting Murray directly in the chest twice.
Jeez.
Murray calls him a twit as the third round fires off, and the guard approaches, realizing his error and looking over the bloodied Murray, and frantically tries to dial someone before apologizing to him for the shooting. Murray tells him he's fired before rolling his head to the side as he comes back to in his bedroom once again with the ambience of the tape echoing again. We see Raymond then seated on his bed, smoking a cigar and laughing. Murray questions, is he still trapped? Raymond confirms he's catching on, to which Murray argues that he signed the papers. They shook on it. Raymond then reminds him, what was that you said to me in the store? Art of the deal, and begins to laugh evilly again, repeating, yes, sir, art of the deal. Murray states again, but we shook hands, and Raymond viciously responds with, so? He tells Murray he's out of here as Murray begs him not to leave. The episode then ends as we cut to Freddy lounging, spraying Banaka in his mouth, who says, to sleep, perchance to dream. And then it just repeats over and over again, to dream. To dream.
But not like a video thing. He's just saying to dream over and over again.
Yes. And that is very the odd. End of the light at the end of the tunnel.
Very odd ending.
My God.
And I mean, I felt like Freddy was kind of on top of his game throughout a lot of this.
He was. He was definitely the most memorable.
Well, yeah.
Oh, no. We just almost got out.
Just play it cool. Just play it cool, Dave.
Play it cool.
Hey, bitch.
Hey, Freddy.
How you doing, Freddy?
Oh, you know, better than you.
That's fair.
You know, I don't appreciate being censored. I've always been very anti-censorship.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to hear what I said on the show that they couldn't play?
I would love to, Freddy.
Well, basically I said, I don't even think it's that offensive. I said,
oh my God.
Wait. Well, but in context, it was the with a in a river of shit, you cunt.
Freddy, you can't say any of that.
What is podcasting? There's no censorship. If I want Chinese laundry potato, I can.
You can't say that about the president, though.
Well, not of this country.
Oh.
But if I want to take a with a and make potato and do it up, you know what? I
think Freddy just canceled us.
My work here is done.
Ugh, what a nightmare.
Damn it. Right when I had a mouthful of a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
Bye, Freddy.
Bye, Freddy. He couldn't resist.
I don't think he even said anything. I think he just produced
the beep?
A censor.
That's from impressive.
So let's give this episode a rating and get out of here.
Well, that sounds good. So his, as we said, his interactions are top notch.
I mean, throwing things off screen
the family,
and then them landing
the
in
family
there,
opening,
murdering that family. Well, yeah, just hanging 100%. The mom, throwing the knife.
A story I think is awesome. B story I think is pretty good as well. That said, I'm gonna give this a solid C. C plus.
Okay, I was gonna give it a B minus.
Okay,
because that opener, I really loved it with all
opener
the kids
gets an
scare
A plus.
Stuff. But the video store stuff with the sleaze,
yeah,
he just keeps waking up but not being awake, and they do it so much that it becomes funny again,
yeah.
And it becomes weird again.
And I thought
so
the
I really
ending of the A story was incredibly sweet with him and his inner child, I guess.
Oh, and him going completely insane.
I mean, that too. Yeah, of course. Who wouldn't love that? So, I'm going to solid C plus.
Okay. Well, that is it, my friends. We got to get out of here. So thank you for listening to Welcome to Prime Time, a Freddy's Nightmares podcast. If you want to send us an email, we would love to hear from you. Just go to freddysnightmares.com or send an email to freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com. Also, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting app. It really does help out. And make sure you're subscribed, because every week we're here talking about Freddy's Nightmares.
That we are. And tune in next week for season 1, episode 20, Identity Crisis, directed by David Calloway, who's the cinematographer for 41 episodes of Freddy's Nightmares.
And that would be episode 21.
Episode 21. That's what I said.
You said 20.
Oh, I said 21.
Folks, email and let us know if you said 20. I heard 20.
Oh, no.
But we'll see you all next time. Until then, stay asleep.
Sweet dreams.